Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And we are glad to be back together, speaking to you, even though we are 6,000 miles apart.
Yeah.
Me in a snow-swept Scotland, and you in a?
Very beautiful, bright, sunny Los Angeles.
People will wonder what's new. But one of the things which we have been doing over the last few weeks is traveling an awful lot. We have been driving up and down Europe. We have been visiting many sites and connecting with many lovely friends. And on our ways, I got reacquainted with certain things which you definitely practice and which is actually the foundation of so much of the work you do, which is the personal experience of a place, the information a place gives you, everything which goes on from there. And, you know, people who know us and who travel with us, not necessarily on the organized tours, but definitely in private, will know that sometimes we make plans and then these plans change because new information comes about. And various people have done this. We've interviewed a few people who have been doing their archaeological research like that. Probably the most famous of them of which we've interviewed is Andy Collins, who actually termed or coined the term, rather, psychic archaeology, whereby basically he feels that archaeology should be led, or definitely can be led, by inspiration, by insights, which you then have to go out into the books, into the field, and proof. And really, when you start to think of it, so much of the great finds of archaeology have been made like that. I'm writing a new book, which is probably going to be called The Lost Civilization Enigma. And in it, I give archaeologists, once again, a good run for their money and show how professional archaeologists can be amongst the wickedest creatures in the world. But also, by writing this book, I'm kind of like flabbergasted to find that all the major discoveries in the world have always been done by amateur archaeologists. These professionals really seem to be, in quite often, many cases, incapable of making big archaeological discoveries. Most of the time, they are done by farmers in fields. In some other cases, obviously, there is this psychic thing. And I'll begin with a story which I think is probably amongst the most famous ones, but there are several of them. And this is the story of Glastonbury Abbey. It is one of the chief places, the chief abbeys. It was one of the richest abbeys in England, together with that of St. Andrews. It was sacked at the time of Henry VIII. And pretty much an awful lot of it disappeared, even though it was sitting in the center of the town of Glastonbury. And it was in the middle, early parts of the 20th century, that a person called Frederick Bligh Bond became interested in Glastonbury and began to do excavations. And as the excavations went on, and as he found sites of the abbey, he became more open in his comments as to why he knew where to dig precisely. And he was saying that actually he was told where to dig because he was conversing with a monk who had obviously died several centuries ago, but who in life had lived and worked in the abbey, and who was showing him basically where all of these things were. And so whenever Frederick began to dig, he was not just digging haphazardly, but he knew where he was digging. And clearly, I think that gives him a great advantage over so many archaeologists who basically have no idea where to dig. And today, Glastonbury is one of those great sites, beautiful. You and I have been there. And in the Georgian Pilgrim, up in the heart of Glastonbury, opposite the abbey, we have inscriptions on the wall which basically tell the story of how Frederick Bond was able to uncover the riches of Glastonbury Abbey. And now, in his case, it was a bit of bravura which made him open up to the fact that this was happening. But I'm just wondering how many hundreds of people have been doing digs, maybe even several professional archaeologists who really are trying to keep that secret.
Well, I also think that it happens sometimes in cases where maybe the archaeologist doesn't know that they're getting necessarily help. They have a hunch. They have an instinct. They have an intuition about where to dig or to look somewhere else that no one else has looked. You know, we often joke about a very ridiculous and very entertaining show that was on last year called Chasing Mummies, which was a documentary that took place in Egypt. Primarily around the antics of Zahi Hawass and things that were going on in terms of various digs in Egypt. But one of the things in the show that I actually was really taken by had little to do with Zahi Hawass and everything to do with another archaeologist, a woman who was in the Alexandria area, who has devoted much of her life to searching for Cleopatra's tomb. And in listening to her talk about her passion for looking for this tomb, you could hear her say things like, you know, I feel that it's here. You know, I have a feeling. Now, I want to stress that, oh, by the way, I believe this woman's name is Dr. Kathleen Martinez. I didn't want to leave out her name because she's really exceptional. And I want to emphasize that this woman is a scientist and she has done extraordinary amounts of research and due diligence and is digging from the point of view of a scientist. But you can hear when she talks about her passion for finding this, that there's something else going on, you know, and whether that's subconscious or divinely guided or what it is, you know, in listening to her, I was thinking she's following something that goes beyond science. So I think that we often see this, whether we know it or not, that many of these archaeological explorations and discoveries do occur because these, quote, amateurs are able to follow something that leads them there.
Absolutely. I think, I mean, just stepping beyond the archaeological framework, I think it's also which happens outside the bounds of archaeology. I think it was Kekule who had a vision of some form of chemical structure when he was basically asleep. Archimedes, I believe, is the one who was in the bathtub. All of these things happen quite often not when somebody is diligently bowing over a piece of paper and kind of like, you know, making extreme calculations. In fact, first of all, most of these discoveries seem to be when you open up your mind and relax. But also, it seems when you open yourself up to other influences. And one of the greatest geniuses of all times, Nikola Tesla, was definitely somebody who was, first of all, very shy and very private as to what was going on, and the more old he grew, the more private he became. But there's definitely hints that this information was not his, that this was somehow given to him. In my book, The Ancient Alien Question, I talk about the story of Edward Leed Skelton, who built Coral Castle in Florida, and he was able to build with gigantic stones weighing tons and tons and tons. And when they asked him, how did you do it, he basically said that he had inherited this knowledge from the ancient builders. Well, the question is, how did those ancient builders give that to him? Because, you know, clearly they were thousands of years ago, and they didn't leave any specific writing and then sent it via registered mail to somebody whom they had no idea about would live thousands of years in the future. So how did that information come to him? And I think archaeology is you know, another example of that. And definitely, since I have been traveling with you, my dear, I have come to the insight that, you know, being guided to certain places rather than just haphazardly taking off places or going to places hoping you will find something, having a kind of otherworldly guide or guidance is probably a better word for that, is far better and a far more productive approach.
And it's so much more fun. Yes, I mean, that's how I work, as you know. That's how I've always worked. And you have certainly discovered that working with me in the last few years. I will set out with a very well-researched point of view. And I think that, you know, for me, it's important to say this. This is not woo-woo, gooey, new-agey stuff in a way that it's, oh, it's channeled material. We channel the material and we write it down. It doesn't work like that for us. The journey is inspired. We will go and research something because we are inspired to do it. So in other words, the difference between what we're doing and what our man in Glastonbury was doing is we are not simply taking channeled material or messages or things that inspire us and then translating them immediately as fact. We don't do that. What we do is we research a period or a person or a point of view that is fascinating to us, and then we go in search of it. We go and we explore that place. And this is why I say over and over and over again, you do not know a place or a person or a piece of history until you have been where that history has lived. You can read as many books as you want, but unless you are sitting in the middle of the place where it took place, the place where it occurred, you don't ever really have the essence of it, because there is so much information in the earth, in the architecture, in the place names, things that you can't even imagine until you are actually there. But there is a bit of an art to exploring that. And also, you have to be able to let yourself go a little bit. You know, sometimes when we're traveling, we have a pretty strict plan because we have a schedule. We've got to be in this place at this time and this place at this time. And all of a sudden, something will come to you that you have to do that's not on the plan. And you have to be flexible enough to say, uh-oh, we need to follow this and see where it takes us. Because it's always those moments where you end up someplace that you couldn't possibly have dreamed of. And that's very exciting for me. So, you know, it's like having a research assistant that is connected to the divine. You know, all of a sudden you'll just get this flash of inspiration, or you'll just hear something that says, no, go here instead. Or, you know, I always call it the little man syndrome. A little man will walk down the street and suddenly tell you, oh, you should go look at this. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that's happened. You know, I tell these stories in my books, and Maureen has these experiences, you know, the experiences in The Expected One where Maureen is given the ring, that happened to me in Jerusalem. The experience in The Expected One where Maureen is in the Basilica of the Holy Sepulchre, and the little man comes up and tugs on her sleeve and knows her name and tells her exactly where to go and what to look at. That happened to me. Those things like that have happened to me all my life, certainly in doing this work for the last 20 years. And as a result, I really feel like I've had some kind of divine helper who has shown me the way to find and explore some of these things that I would have never, ever been able to find if I had just sat in a library.
Absolutely, and I mean, one of the things which we are exploring quite intently is the megalithic civilization. And you know, for people who still have no idea what we're talking about, this doesn't involve a session with a Ouija board and then we know everything about the megalithic civilization.
No,
and then we go and kind of like, you know, try to find evidence for it. It's very specific. It's almost little details. I would say that, you know, there is a megalithic civilization out there. Both you and I know an awful lot about it. But it is when we come to these places and you connect to these places and to its past that there is kind of a unveiling almost of the site, whereby things become more clear, that knowledge which we have in our heads can be reinterpreted or can be seen from a slightly different perspective because we knew it, but we didn't understand it. And so, if anything, that the kind of psychic archaeology is more about understanding rather than just facts about certain places, that it is more trying to really get what happened there, what is important about a site, rather than just random facts or endless facts.
Well, you know, I wanted to tell a really quick story about something that happened to us recently when we were in Karnak. In fact, this was just 2 weeks ago when we were there. And this is now, we've been back there three times in the last, well, within the last 12 months, because there is so much information to be understood and absorbed there that we have to keep going back. And looking at it and, you know, that those stones are so magnificent and this, there are so many different collections of them. There, you know, that was for me when I first went to Karnak and I first visited that piece of Brittany with you, I was so overwhelmed and impressed and excited by the vastness of it that, you know, these stones are everywhere and there are these concentrations of them dotted all over this part of Brittany. And I had no idea that it was such a profoundly vast area that was covered with these megaliths. And that for me was really exciting. And so as a result, you know, every time I go there, I feel like, oh gosh, we've still only scratched the surface. You go back and you can focus on one pile of rocks for years. And as you know, a lot of people have done that. So, you know, we have been going back to these particular areas and we have a certain collection of stones in the Karnak region that we are particularly in love with and that actually speak to us. And I'll back up a little bit and say that, you know, I was raised in a kind of unusual environment and the Irish side of my family is actually very big on talking to nature. And they have a very strong understanding that stones hold information. The Irish have long believed this and for many, many millennia. And when you think about it, it makes sense, particularly these enormous megalithic structures that are built of granite. Well, granite is made up of quartz. There's little pieces of quartz and silica in this granite. And, you know, silica is exactly what the Silicon Valley is famous for. You know, silica is the material that holds information in our computers. And silica is, you know, is in our computer chips and runs our watches and everything else. So why wouldn't that silica, when it's in a rock formation in its most natural place, not hold information? So certainly this is something I was actually raised with, which was this idea of psychometry. Psychometry being you put your hands on something that can hold information and you allow it to tell you its story. And that's one of the things that we've been doing in Karnak. And I know certainly people are going to say, oh, well, that's just nuts, and let them say that. But I will, you know, and you can also attest to this. Over the last year, we have received some extraordinary information by doing this. And again, like I said, when we get this information, it's not simply a matter of, oh, let's jot it down and call it history. It's let's jot it down and then let's investigate it. Let's go see if we can prove any of this information. Let's go see if we can dig and find archaeological evidence. And we have been able to do that. We have found things in the museums. We have found artifacts. We have found things that have brought us there. But in terms of the quest, something happened to us 2 weeks ago where one particular stone, who we refer to as Papa, because he has a big, beautiful face on him and he looks like the grandfather of all the stones, said when we were speaking with him, go find the place where the stones meet the sea. And he gave us a couple of clues about where he wanted us to go. He didn't tell us what it was called. He didn't tell us what we were looking for. But he gave us enough general information for us to go out on this treasure hunt and find this place. And that was incredibly fun for us. You know, we pulled out the maps, we started looking around, and ultimately, what did we find?
We found the site.
We found an extraordinary, extraordinary cairn where the stones meet the sea, in a place that I probably would have never seen otherwise or found otherwise. And it turns out to be, I think, one of the places that's incredibly important for our research.
Absolutely. And that is, once again, you know, when you're confronted with a site like the megalithic civilization around Karnak, there are thousands of stones. And it's very hard to, again, there are so many facts, there is so much information available there. that it is very hard to distinguish what is important, what isn't, and how it all fits together. And this is part of the reason why nobody's ever put that picture together. But, you know, when you start doing it and when you're getting some help from Big Rocks, all of a sudden it becomes a different playing field. And all of a sudden you are sorting out the wheat from the chaff. And specifically, you are guided to information. And, I mean, you know, one of the things which happened early on with Papa was the fact that I knew that our ancestors believed that megaliths had to do with the ancestors, that there was a belief that the souls could only travel in straight lines. And even though I knew all of that, and some of it I had known for almost 20 years, in fact, some of it I had known for 20 years, I had never applied that information to Karnak because somehow it had been compartmentalized in my head. It sat in a different part of my brain, and there clearly it had been stuck for two decades. Yet Papa, through you, began to say certain things which made it look absolutely obvious and also made it to me like, okay, why has nobody else figured this one out yet? Because once you know, it's so obvious.
Well, and I want to tell another quick story. When we were crawling around the stones one day, there was a field trip of French children who were there. And I would say they're probably about Shane's age, maybe a little bit younger. So my son Shane is 10. I would say these kids were probably 8, 9, 10 in that region. And it was a field trip, you know, for these kids to come and play on the stones. And they let the kids run around and they let them climb on the stones, which I was, you know, we were laughing as we were watching the kids, you know, jumping on the stones and climbing around on these enormous things, thinking, okay, this would never happen in an American school, where they would all be forced to stay in a line and have to obey a lot of rules. But these kids were really free to explore these stones. And there was a moment when the teacher, one of the teachers who was young and male, and he was so lovely, and you could tell that he was probably from that region. He'd probably grown up on these rocks himself. And he said to the kids, all right, now I want you to listen to the stones. Put your ears against the stones and listen to the stones because they will talk to you because they are magic. And we all sat there, you know, us and the friends who were with us, and we all just went, wow, wow, how great is that, that these kids are being taught this. You know, they're being taught to come to these stones and put their ears against it and listen to them because the stones will talk to them. And that was a big moment for me. It was a beautiful moment for me.
And it definitely inspires, you know, hope for the next generation of people that they are invited to listen to these things. Now, one of my first exposures, I said, in psychic archaeology was with Andy Collins. And a number of his books, like The Seventh Sword and various actually self-published books in the 1980s and the 1990s, talk about this quest which he does in search of swords or things which appear. And I think we're definitely going to come back to artifacts. You already mentioned your ring, but there are several others, and how they tell stories as well. But the, you know, one of Andy then disappeared with more what I would call mainstream books, whereby he tried to do these things in a more stricter way. But in, I think, 2000 or 2001, he wrote 21st Century Grail. And in it, he tackles the story of Ren Le Chateau. And basically what had happened was that his main psychic, all of a sudden, quite out of the ordinary and unintentionally, had begun to channel or receive information from an episode of Ren Le Chateau, which I'll go into in a second. And basically he had tried to get this information substantiated, but because it was somewhat outside of the usual bailiwick of Ren Le Chateau material, it hadn't really been all that successful, and the resulting book was a bit of a mismatch of information. So Andy, his wife, and I met in a pub just off the British Museum, and I said to Andy, okay, let's pretend this book hasn't existed, just start from scratch what Richard has been saying. And he began to relate the story, and what came out was a very interesting story, which I, over the next few years, tried to substantiate. And it involved little details like, you know, underground parts to a church, which turned out to be real, even though they themselves had never been in there. And from the outside, you would never guess that this church had this underground component. The same thing with a castle. Neither of them, I should add, are in Rennes-le-Château, and for obvious reasons I will not mention them, where they specifically are, so that treasure hunters don't necessarily have to go there. But part of this story involved the murder of Abbé Gély, who is one of those very mysterious incidents who always get dragged into the mystery of Rennes-le-Château. And what had happened was that Richard one day had basically seen the murder happen through the eyes of the assassin, which was obviously extremely disturbing to him. But he connected to this assassination and provided certain details, some of which were very detailed, as in, for example, the fact that there was blood on the second floor of the house. And that this was left behind by the assassin because he was disturbed by a sound outside and he went upstairs to look through the window and see what was going on downstairs. But specifically, one thing really was an extraordinarily detailed, and that was this. Richard had seen that the assassin had placed the body of the abbé in a very specific position, namely that of the hung man of the tarot card, which meant that rather than his both legs next to each other, one leg was basically crossed to the on the other around the knee area. And this was something which, you know, was a unique allegation, and the only thing which pretty much everybody knew was that the Abbé Gély had been laid out as a mark of respect, but everybody had always assumed that this was just as any dead person was laid out with, you know, the arms over the belly, the head straight, and the legs straight as well. Well, I began to look into this, and specifically the police files, which since then have obviously become public knowledge. And first of all, what I found interesting was that the early public reports, the press releases, the newspaper articles didn't mention anything whatsoever about the position in which he was found and specifically the position of the legs. And to some extent it was interesting because there would be other details in there, but not that. Now, for people who are aware with the way police works, and there are hundreds of television shows who do so, they will know that the police will not release certain details of information, so that when somebody contacts them with certain information, that person can quickly be sussed out as being legit or just somebody who wants to be part of the action. And so the fact that the police wasn't saying something about legs, to me, was very interesting, because to me it meant that they were hiding something and that there probably was something very specific there. But the question was whether, you know, that meant that what Richard had seen was true or not was an entirely different issue. Now, Richard, it has to be said, didn't speak French, had never heard of the mystery of Rennes-le-Château beyond the most basic things. So all of this was, you know, not somebody who was trying to con or whatever, impress his friend Andy Collins. Anyway, I had to dig very deep into very specific pieces of this police file to find out that indeed there was some anomaly with the legs. Now, the police file didn't specifically state that this was the position of the hangman of the tarot, because that is obviously something which, you know, you wouldn't find in a police report. That's an interpretation. But definitely the legs were not next to each other, and one was over the other. So it could absolutely have been the case that this was the position of the tarot. Furthermore, the fact that it was always said that the body was laid out clearly meant that some people actually recognized the very specific nature of the pose in which Abbé Gelly was left. And so basically what happened was here a man who had a vision, who jumped into the head of an assassin, who reported something, a minute detail, which was so hard to trace back and, you know, find out about. But when I did, it actually showed that this was correct. And obviously whatever else he had seen immediately took on far more importance in me than anything before. And so that's a very, just one example of so many, which basically shows that it isn't all about just getting some information and then it's done. If anything, it's when the hard work starts.
Well, and I also want to give a shout out to Andy Collins here, because I do have so much respect for the work that Andy has done in this field, because he really was a big pioneer in this idea of psychic archaeology and psychic exploration in terms of being guided to find artifacts. And, I've told this story in the past, but it bears repeating. It was in the early 90s. I want to say it was probably 1991. No, it had to have been 1991. No later than that. I was in a now, unfortunately, the Bodhi Tree bookstore in Los Angeles, which was once the biggest metaphysical bookstore in the world, no longer exists. It closed its doors on New Year's Eve after many, many years of being a place of inspiration for people like me. But I was wandering through the aisles of the Bodhi Tree bookstore back in 1990 or 1991 when a book literally fell on my head. Talk about, getting a message. This book literally fell on my head, and it was a little paperback called The Green Stone. And this one wasn't written by Andy. It was written by Graham Phillips and Martin Keatman, I believe. But Andy is involved in it, and it is the quest that they go on to find these artifacts. And it's the book is out of print, and it's actually worth getting if you can find it on a books or a used book search, because it's quite fascinating. This and they end up teaming up with a young girl who I think is 11 or 12 who starts having also these same visions, and they find some really extraordinary artifacts on this journey. And I remember that book really rocked my world when I read it. And then there were some subsequent follow-ups. And then Andy wrote a book called The Seventh Sword, also in the 90s, which really, really had a huge impact on me. I mean, it was Andy's work that really gave me the courage to sort of take this idea of listening to another level and really going after it in my explorations in Europe. So I have to credit Andy for doing that, because by 1995, by the time I started doing this in earnest in France, which is, the episodes that really created what happened in The Expected One happened in 1995 when I follow these psychic adventures through France in very much the way that Maureen does. I really have to hearken that back to Andy's explorations and adventures sort of giving me the courage to do that.
Absolutely, and he will say that he is guided by artifacts as well, and quite often that these artifacts, whether they are swords, whether they are green stones, they seem to want to tell a story, and quite often those are the kind of artifacts which are otherwise left out. We tend to think of the megalithic civilization, the Great Pyramid of Giza, lost civilizations who want to tell stories. But everybody wants to tell a story. Whether it's a dead person or whether it is a small artifact, there is a story connected to each one of that. And, people can connect to that history of that artifact. And I'm always reminded of the fact that up until relatively recent times, about 200 years ago or so, the cemeteries were always next to the churches. And so when people came to church on Sunday, they were literally surrounded by the dead. They were surrounded by the tombs of their family, their ancestors, and they communicated with God and in the presence of their ancestors. And then Urbanization basically meant that the dead were put to the edge of the town and became more and more literally a sideshow. But you just wonder, you know, how more closely our ancestors lived with their ancestors. And this is something which you see throughout history as well. People seeking out their ancestors in trying to communicate with them. And there is this beautiful passage which says that nothing truly dies for as long as something is remembered. And definitely I think the Egyptians were prominent in that they actually believed that mummies and parts of the souls could be placed into stones, that, you know, you can go to a statue of Sekhmet, basically that you can communicate with the goddess Sekhmet there, and that this isn't accidental, but that the ancient Egyptians somehow had the tools or the techniques to accomplish this, to embed a divine intelligence or the mind of a deceased person into an object. And I think that is, you know, to some extent a forgotten science, which we all know about. We all know that an object was used, and research like Rupert Sheldrake with morphogenetic fields basically suggests that, you know, everything has memory, that everything is to some extent memory, and that we can connect with this. But I think the ancient Egyptians went one step further, maybe, and actually made it into a science, realized that they could play with this, realized that they could do such more with that. And I guess to a large extent, this is kind of like where it is time to introduce, like, this concept of the Emerald Tablets, which is basically said to have been tablets which were embedded with all the history of the world, which a lost civilization felt they had to do. And I, whenever I talk or think of Emerald Tablets, I also think of crystal skulls, whereby we have quartz crystal, which today we use in our computers, in our watches. We know it stores information. And we have seen on numerous occasions that when people connect with crystal skulls, they connect with an intelligence. They connect with a pool of information which they can access. And again, you know, what's the difference between a crystal skull or a granite stone surface of a megalith somewhere? They are, in essence, the same kind of hardware. And our hard science, our computer science, on a daily basis is showing us, and we are using it on a daily basis as well, that these things can store information and that we can extract information from them in very physical means.
And that's where, you know, it should be very exciting, even to people who maybe shy away from, you know, some of these, you know, this. Sometimes when you say the word psychic, people immediately go, ah, you know, they run from it and they don't want to hear about it. But when you look at the applications of it, you know, and you look at this potential science that can contribute to it or that is behind it, I think it changes things. You know, Dr. Carmen Bolter, who is someone we've had on the show here, is an extraordinary psychic archaeologist. She is someone who has this brilliant combination of, you know, of science and academia and education, but also of spirit and inspiration. And watching her work in the Pyramid Code and some of the things that she's working on now is very, very exciting. And also the fact that she's pretty fearless about coming forward and saying this is who I am and this is how I work. And I really love that about her. And I'm hoping that more people will be more vocal about the fact that, you know, there is this beautiful second dimension to exploration. There is a second and even a third dimension to learning about our human history and our past. And so much more opens up to us if we will just allow that to happen.
Absolutely. And of course, we also interviewed Caroline Dees, who we interviewed about Om Sethi, who I think was very much also in that psychic archaeology mindset. She remembered previous incarnations when she was a temple priestess in some of the places, specifically the Osirion in Egypt. But there's a very big difference, I think, between what we have been saying here and then some things which, you know, other people quite often will walk away with, which is that somehow people think that they are Nefertiti or that they think that they are King Khufu. All of those things quite often lead to big theories. I would call it more channeled material, which never goes anywhere, which are just these big lumps of information which sit somewhere, which quite often begin to lead a life of their own, which are hardly ever substantiated. From personal experience, whether it is, you know, with Papa or the accounts which we were relating, which happened to Andy Collins, these stones don't give you the entire story. They are like brief insights. They are glimpses of where you should go next. But it's not like, you know, you can interrogate somebody and that person gives up all of its secrets and gives you out all the information. It's not that simple. It's not like that.
No, and it's not meant to be that way. I mean, again, this is how we differentiate between people who say, oh, I have channeled material and therefore here's the answers, versus gaining an inspiration and then going off and seeking on your own. And there is a very big distinction. And I think that when something, you know, I love getting these sort of challenges going on. I call it the spiritual scavenger hunt, right? You know, these divine challenges. Okay, go find the place where the stones meet the sea, and here's what you're looking for. You know, it's like you couldn't script this stuff for The Amazing Race. You know, our whole life is turned into The Amazing Race because we are following these clues, and it's really exciting. And the same thing's happening in the land of the Boleyns right now. You know, we're doing all this research on Anne Boleyn, and we have really boldly gone where no other Boleyn researcher has gone before, in that we are doing, you know, our damnedest to dig into where Anne could have been, might have been, was for sure during her years in France. And to my knowledge, nobody else has done this. And whereas we have taken all of this from, you know, doing multiple years now of research in multiple languages and with lots and lots of different sources, when we get out on the road, we never know what we're going to find. And unfortunately, for reasons of propriety, I can't necessarily expose what we did find recently or some of the things that we have come across, because we need to protect that for the book. Or books that we are both working on, but I will say that it has been an extraordinary journey. And whether it's Anne or, you know, somebody else, or just some sort of higher guidance that is showing us these things, there is something really extraordinary about being in the locations and allowing yourself to be guided. Once again, you know, we're in a small village in France a couple of weeks ago that is really important. Everyone knows it's important, yet no one ever goes there. No one visits it. No Boleyn scholar or art scholar, to my knowledge, has ever written about this little village, and it's of critical importance. And yet just in being there, something happens. And I want to take that to another level for a second and say, maybe it's in being there that something in the place is activated as well. I think that there's a partnership that happens when people of open mind and spirit approach a place that has a story to tell. I mean, that place never doesn't have a story to tell. It just, if someone is not there to hear it, it never gets told. And so that's, I think, for me, the most fulfilling and exciting part about what we're doing. We're going to these places that have had stories to tell for a really long time, and we are finding these stories only because we're listening. But what we learned in this village was extraordinary, and we learned it because being there activated something. It caused an important local person to come and speak to us, to show us things we wouldn't have seen otherwise, to point us in direction of something else. You know, and that's not all happenstance. I mean, you know, we're there looking at local phone numbers. You're calling people in French locally, trying to find out who's got the key to the church. And, you know, I mean, we're doing our due diligence as researchers, but I think it's the energy of doing that due diligence as researchers that also opens up this sort of amazing system of support and guidance that every single time takes us to some extraordinary piece of evidence.
Absolutely, and I think it's connecting to the place. You know, I mean, in this specific case, we were there all by ourselves, and this connection to a place is always far easier to do when you are alone or private rather than surrounded by 15,000 people, as in places like Versailles or, you know, the Louvre or wherever. And I think, you know, that is one aspect of it. But I also think it's a kind of comfort level of being there and being open and saying, I am here to basically find out about this place because I don't know about this place. I mean, again, we know lots of knowledge about it, but we have no real understanding. So let this place guide us into providing us the answers. And I think this is kind of like almost diametrically opposed to really what science is all about. Science teaches all its practitioners that you need to have a theory and then you need to go out and either prove or disprove it. And I think that's simply the wrong way about going about these things. I think it's the wrong thing. You need to have the knowledge, then you go out there, and then that knowledge somehow has to become maybe not necessarily quickly wisdom, but definitely leading to an understanding. And I think in one case, in the scientific methodology, you go to a place with a preconceived idea, and that's either going to be right or wrong. And in the other case, you're not really that bothered. You're just open, and you open yourself up to the environment. And I guess, you know, being open and allowing yourself to be open is from your perspective, a very key ingredient in making that connection.
I think it is the ingredient making that connection. I think that you have to go into it with an openness. I think you have to be willing to get out of your own way. I think you have to be willing to put aside the I know so much because I've done so much research idea and say, I'm going to approach this absolutely open and see where it takes me. And I think that really makes all the difference. And I think that maybe that's a bit of a strategy for life in general, that the more open you can be about where it can take you, sort of the greater the adventure. And it's certainly been true in our research.
Absolutely. And I mean, we've been talking about some artifacts, whether they're big like Papa or whether they're small like some of the swords and green stones. But we kind of like touched upon it very briefly, but probably the greatest archaeological or mythical kind of like mystery object, which was guiding people into doing things and speculating about the future, was, of course, the Grail itself, specifically in the Wolfram tradition, whereby this stone was said to have magical powers, was pretty much said to bend time and space and was able to provide great insights. But what happened in the Grail court was that they were fussing so much over it that they basically weren't happy. And it's only when they realized that this object will be able to take care of itself that they're beginning to sort of enjoy the fact that they have all of this wealth, and not physical wealth, but like spiritual wealth and insight at their disposal, and that they can actually do these things. And again, as you said, it's when the Grail Court steps out of its own problems and just lets the rock be, that the rock is able to provide happiness for them.
Well, and I think for me, you know, what I pray for is for people to become more and more open to these ideas of this kind of exploration, and seeing where it does in fact take them. Because even, you know, even now, and people are getting better about it, but still, I mean, there are people who would listen to this broadcast and go, okay, those people are nuts. And even, you know, in terms of writing out our research, you know, we have to be a little bit careful about how we present it, you know, because if people think that it's channeled or, you know, that we're following all these crazy things around Europe, then they may not take it seriously. So, you know, I'm kind of in a place right now where I have to determine whether or not that bothers me. You know, certainly when I was writing The Expected One, I had to come to a place of saying, you know what, I'm going to tell people that these things happened to me. I had these visions, I had these experiences, and I followed them, and that's what happened, and that's, you know, how I wrote this book. But it is a little bit of a double-edged sword because some people are still really, really not, you know, ready to accept it. And yet, I think that, you know, for us, we're writing this book about Anne Boleyn, for example, Avenging Anne Boleyn. You know, neither one of us really, I think, has the desire to write a traditional academic book on Anne. I don't necessarily want to write something that would be what an Eric Ives or an Alison Weir would write. I certainly don't want to write anything that an Alison Weir would write. But I think that, you know, what we're creating is a bit of a journey. It's a book about really uncovering all these events and people and places that point to such a different portrait of who this woman is historically, because we got out of the library, because we went out and went in search of it, and in many cases followed our hunches, our intuition, our guidance, whatever you want to call it. And I think that's an exciting way to tell this story and to present, you know, new information in a new age.
Absolutely. And anyway, it really goes back to the central issue of the Grail quest, which is that the quest is as important as the Grail, because without the quest you can't get to the Grail. And the reason why our books on Anne Boleyn are going to be containing new information is because we have been on that quest. We have been to these places. We have seen different aspects to Anne, rather than just accumulating knowledge and then deciding to slightly represent it somewhat differently, because you feel that in that body of knowledge certain things have been presented somewhat askew. And that is simply, you know, a completely different approach from what we are doing. That approach is very much the academic way of saying, well, my thesis is this, and I'm going to collect the evidence for this. We didn't have any, you know, preconceived notions, and to some extent, on aspects of Anne Boleyn, they are still being formed because we are continuing to visit some of the places involved and are continuing to accumulate information. But this view of who Anne was and what she truly did grew. It didn't begin as a thesis which we were setting out to prove or disprove. And I think, to me, that is the beauty, but also the importance of so many things, which is that I think history and true discoveries are far better served by an open mind rather than the academic approach of thesis and then trying to prove or disprove it.
Well, I think that it's time for a new approach. I mean, one of the things that we have talked about on this show before and is a sort of a key element of the way that we work is that, you know, history, the way that we have traditionally been presented it, doesn't work. It's not true. You know, it's full of propaganda and manufactured information written by the victors. I mean, this is not a new idea for us. But what is new is to say, okay, if we accept that history is not what happens, and strictly what was written down, then how do we get to a new understanding of what history might be? How do we get to the next understanding of who we are as humans? And that's where this kind of exploration, I think, is very exciting and does take us to new places. And it's part and parcel of something that I believe spiritually, and is part of my own quest in terms of the stories that I tell. And that is that we have been robbed of our right to be mystical. We have our nature as mystics, which is what I believe all humans are, has been taken from us over, you know, 2,000 years of traditional religion, of politics, of oppression, of dogma, of economics, of all of these things that have oppressed us into some version of ourselves that not only doesn't know that we're mystics, but in many cases doesn't even recognize it, or, you know, at its worst, persecutes it and ridicules mysticism. And this is what I personally am so passionate about trying to rehabilitate, which is this understanding that we really are mystics. We all have this deep connection to something that is divine and great and full of wonder and information. And there are so many little ways that we can tap into this, you know? I mean, just for the average person who's listening to this, who might be thinking, I'd love to have these kinds of adventures. You know, how do you do this? It's so simple in terms of, you know, even just in your own day-to-day life. Everyone has these moments where they have an intuition, where something says, you know, maybe I should go there today. You know, give yourself the freedom to explore that, you know, have absolutely nothing to do on one day and wake up and see where that day takes you. See where you're guided to go, because it's like anything else. You have to kind of exercise it a little bit. You know, the more you do it, the more used to it you get to actually opening yourself up and allowing yourself to follow your intuition and explore. You know, the easier it becomes and the more help you get. The other thing is when something happens in your life that you recognize as, oh, I had a piece of inspiration or a piece of guidance and I followed it and a good thing happened or a fascinating thing happened, the more that you acknowledge that and put energy toward the fact that this is working, I am feeling connection and being grateful, because gratitude is the essence of all things, being grateful for it, that is when this kind of support and divine guidance, I think, really begins to flow very freely.
Absolutely. And it's hard to say, but I feel like we are ruled now with a little communication from a quartz crystal, which says that time is up for this week. And unfortunately, we have to abide by that. But this has been another episode of The Spirit Revolution. If you want to listen to this episode again, you can do so in a number of ways. There are the archives on the BBS Radio Archive. We also upload all 5 most recent shows of our Spirit Revolution show to thespiritrevolution.com. We also have more than a year and a half, if not almost 2 years, available on the internet via iTunes, where you can just search for The Spirit Revolution and you will get all of these shows there. But we also continue to do these shows, and we will be back next week with another Spirit Revolution. But until then, from the both of us,
the truth against the world.